This is Frank Gaffney with a word about a truly great American patriot in urgent need. Rich Higgins served in the U.S. Army and as a key civilian Pentagon official and senior strategist on President Trump's National Security Council. After he left the NSC, Rich continued advising Mr. Trump and others about the threats we are facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. He chronicled his experiences over the past 20 years fighting for America First in a terrific memoir entitled The Memo. Now this courageous freedom fighter is gravely ill due to severe complications caused by the Chinese Communist Party virus. He urgently needs help to defray the enormous costs of successive surgeries and a prospective organ transplant. I urge you to join me in contributing to a GoFundMe campaign named Medical Help for Rich Higgins. That's Medical Help for Rich Higgins at GoFundMe.com. God bless you and Rich Higgins.
Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has served our country in a number of capacities in that war for the free world over quite a period of time is our first guest. His name is Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired. He is these days a senior fellow with the Center for Security Policy and a research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies in the country in which he has long been based, Japan. In addition to his service in uniform, he has also been a foreign service officer and a prominent American businessman based in Japan and doing business in the Far East for years. He is a formidable resource, and we're always glad to have a chance to catch up with him and take advantage of his expertise in so many different areas. Grant, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Always good to have you with us.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
You have in particular, Grant, over the course of several decades now, been studying closely what the Chinese Communist Party is up to. And I know you've given a lot of thought to this doctrine that they've called unrestricted warfare, which seems increasingly now unmistakably being brought to bear against our own country as part of what I guess the People's Daily, I think it was back in May of 2019, declared was a people's war against the United States. I'd like to go through with you a couple of examples of the myriad vectors that the lines of attack, I guess you might call them, that the Chinese Communist Party is using against our country. And one that you've been particularly focused on, I know for some time, is Chinese interference in our election process 2020, and that there appears to have been a dress rehearsal for this in the elections the South Korean government had back in April of 2020, which is the subject of an impressive two-volume set that I've just received from the Korea Conservative Political Action Conference, with which you are associated. I understand you had a hand in this product. Talk a little bit about it and your findings, Grant.
Sure, yes. After the South Korean and National Assembly elections in April 2020, and the National Assembly is like their Congress, the incumbent administration, the incumbent party of Moon Jae-in, which is a leftist party, they actually had an overwhelming victory in the election. And what it did is it gave them the ability to pass any legislation they want, and with a couple additional seats to modify the Constitution. But the overwhelming victory was so strange in terms of particularly the statistical aspects to it. And then there were many procedural concerns about, you know, how the voting was actually done, how it was counted, et cetera, that a range of just very regular South Koreans, lawyers, statisticians, professors, just regular people, on their own, they uncovered an immense amount of information demonstrating, I think, pretty close to beyond a reasonable doubt, that the elections were actually manipulated. And they uncovered evidence, certainly compelling evidence, that there was actually a Chinese connection to this, to involve particularly manipulation of the electoral process in a number of different ways.
Give us an example, if you would, of one or two of the ways in which the Chinese apparently intervened and manipulated the outcome of this election, Grant.
Well, one is the electronic counting machines, which were in fact connected to the internet. They were not just simple counters, but were actually very high-tech or very advanced sort of high-tech computers, actually. That's what the experts who had got a look at these said. These are not just regular calculators, but rather this is designed to do something a lot more. The Korean system is very simple, the electoral system, and it has parts by the Chinese company Huawei as part of it. Just technically, it was very easily to hack. The Chinese had access to it. And what you had is you had 40 straight sort of electoral districts where the pro-China candidate, as it is, actually, they all won every single one of them by the same percentage. And say this, so there was a technical aspect to this, and given the Chinese hacking capabilities, they wouldn't have even had to break a sweat to do it. It's a very simple system. Once you're in, you have access to the whole thing. It's different than ours. So there's electronic manipulation, and actually, as I said, the counting process, the paper ballots, you had just evidence of counterfeit ballots, all for the the incumbent party, who is pro-China, that is thought to be a real possibility of where they came from. You had some, for example, some ballots detected that actually were spelled wrong. And they used words that are language that Koreans don't use. And it's the kind that...
These are what's called in the intelligence business a tell, I think, that you've got a problem, Houston. And, you know, what's interesting about this, Grant, of course, is that our friend Mike Lindell of MyPillow fame has now been talking about similar kinds of things happening in our country. He's not the only one, but he has notably been particularly drilling down on this question of whether the Chinese directly interfered with some of our electoral machinery and did so in ways that would have had a material effect on our election. So this is not just an interesting data point of an allied country, to be sure, but a country far away. It's relevant to our own situation, it seems, and perhaps evidence again of this this kind of offensive unrestricted warfare against us. Let me turn to something else that has just turned up in my mailbox today, literally, and I shared it with you, and I'd be interested in your thoughts about it, Grant Newsom. And that is the extent to which agribusiness in this country has been targeted, among many others, of course, for a kind of hollowing out by the Chinese Communist Party. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, the Chinese are interested in really just about any industry. And the things that we wouldn't always think of. We tend to think of, say, the defense industries, fighter jets or submarines. But agriculture is a high priority to them. They can't feed themselves is one problem. So what you have is you've had Chinese going all out for a number of years to steal agricultural technology. You know, that can be, say, hybrid corn seeds. Just the various technologies that are used in farming, which is a high-tech business these days. And there's been a number of cases where Chinese spies, you know, often just seem to be regular businessmen or scientists. They're caught literally crawling through the cornfields where the test, say Monsanto has their test seeds. And what it points out is, as I said, that every industry, every business line is of interest to the Chinese. And it is industrial espionage on it's just an epic scale. You can't believe it.
We have to pause for just a second, Grant. I want to come back to this point, both your own experience with this, a company called Motorola, as a notable victim of these Chinese predations, but also what they've been doing in the maritime space as well. We'll talk about all that and more with Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marines, retired, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are visiting with Colonel Grant Newsom, a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy and a research fellow of a Japanese institute known as the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies, a man with long experience in the Far East, both as a Marine as well as a Foreign Service officer and a businessman. And Grant, I wanted to talk with you a little bit about your own personal experience with business, but just staying with this issue of food and how the Chinese are aggressively seeking to not only dominate the business, the industry worldwide, but also to exploit so voraciously that in fact they may be eliminating things like the world's fisheries. Talk a bit about the immense fleets of these fishing boats and the kind of maritime militia that operates with them. Sometimes I think it's one and the same, but what are they about and how are they conducting themselves around the world?
Well, China's got the biggest fishing fleet of any nation on Earth and probably every nation put together, it seems. And they operate worldwide in the Pacific, off of Africa, Latin America, you name it. The Chinese fishing fleet is out and it operates in sort of big, in large numbers. And also it really just vacuums the ocean. It doesn't show any concern really for what we would consider environmental practices. And it, so it tends to get in so close and operates, as say, so just sweeps the ocean clean that a local fisherman, at, say, off of Africa, Latin America, et cetera, find that they can't catch anything. Also, they get pushed out of their traditional fishing grounds. And the Chinese fishing fleet, it actually subverts companies and businesses and officials on land. So that's why they are allowed to operate really unrestrained. They were off the Galapagos not long ago. And once again, sneaking into protected areas and stripping them clean. It is a global economic crisis, and Greenpeace, etc., say nothing.
Yeah, nowhere to be seen, it seems. Nothing sustainable about the Chinese approach to this. I'm told the Persian Gulf, as an example, is now essentially a fish-free zone, thanks to what the Chinese have been up to in those waters. Let me turn to your own personal experience with a company that used to be a preeminent American technology and telecommunications firm, Motorola. What were the Chinese able to do to and to some extent with Motorola that has largely meant it, you know, a non-entity these days, I think?
Yes. In around 1989, Motorola went into China in a big way. And this was right after the Tiananmen Square massacre. And so Motorola went in, set up shop, manufacturing operations, research and development operations, etc. And what they did is they created their competition. They handed over a lot of technology. What they didn't hand over was easily stolen. And effectively, you had within 6-7 years, companies developed that were making the same things as Motorola and put them out, ultimately came pretty close to putting Motorola out of business. It was one of America's best companies that committed suicide. It was done, it was just a mistake to go into China, and they might as well as actually just hand it over everything and save themselves the trouble.
You know, I was in Chicago a year or two ago, I guess now, talking to people in the electronics industry there, including people who had experience with Motorola. And they said that the Chinese approached these corporate leaders of Motorola and said, we will replicate the entire business operation that you have in one of these suburbs of Chicago, as I recall. I mean, lock, stock, and barrel. I mean, down to the physical plant itself was simply, well, completely copied and began, I guess, the process that you've just talked about of simply expropriating everything of that company. And it's an object lesson to us, that industry, really, not just this particular leader of it at the time. And more to the point, speaks to this issue of global domination that the Chinese very clearly have in mind, whether it's in the corporate sense, resources sense, or data, or militarily. And let me turn to that, if I may. As a military man, I know you're following closely the literal buildup of the Chinese military. Talk a little bit about it, if you would, from the perspective, Grant, of not only an American military officer now retired, but also what our Japanese allies in Taiwan and others in the region, Australia, are perceiving.
What they're perceiving is just this inexorable, steady Chinese military buildup in terms of numbers of ships, aircraft, submarines, and the capabilities that go with it. And it's a buildup in outer space, under the water as well, everywhere. And they're finding themselves outmatched. And the Japanese, who've always been considered as sort of the next best to us in Asia, they will tell you privately that they feel overwhelmed. I say the scale, the scope of the Chinese buildup. And as I said, it combines with capability development, that it is scaring the daylights out of everyone in Asia. And it is causing, just giving us something to work with few countries that want more to do with the United States. But it does depend on what the United States itself is willing to do.
Well, indeed, that is the rub. What is the perception of our willingness to step up and support these allies on the one hand and oppose the Chinese?
Well, it depends. Sometimes people think we're serious and then other times they think we're not. We talk a good game and then they look at the defense budget and it doesn't really increase. We talk a good game and then we allow Chinese drone makers, high-tech companies to do business with Department of Defense, which is just not just asking for trouble, it's just criminally negligent. We send our only aircraft carrier, or we're going to, out of the region. And meanwhile, China's now got three aircraft carriers, and they're cranking out ships at a rate of at least four ships for every one the U.S. is building. I think it's actually beyond that. So people know the U.S. is still powerful. It says it's interested, and sometimes it acts like it, but they see what's coming from China, and there is still plenty of doubt. It's not the end of the game yet, but we're not showing that we're entirely committed. Some days we do, and then other days, our friends out here are left scratching their heads.
The trend line is clearly in the wrong direction, and they would be entitled to be concerned about it. When you talk with them, Grant Newsom, are you perceiving at least some poised to go the route of what might be called a separate peace with the Chinese, simply supplicating themselves to the new reality of the dominant power in that region, even if it comes at great expense to their national sovereignty and interests?
Yes, you do see that. And it's some places that, you didn't used to think it. Singapore, I'm afraid, comes immediately to mind. Then it depends also on when you in a country, which people are you talking about? Within all of these places, there is a constituency that does favor effectively placating the Chinese and not challenging them. And that's really every country, Japan, Australia, South Korea, etc. But there are also constituencies that don't want to do this. And for now, it seems as though some of the main players are sort of holding firm, and particularly Australia deserves a lot of credit in that regard. Japan talks a good game, but they still won't increase their defense budget much. So it's the ball's in play. But you do feel, more sort of demoralization than it used to be. And it's but at the same time, that it is waking some people up. So we're not quite sure how this is going to end up, but it is a very sensitive time.
Right. And the opportunity to change the trajectory of all this, it would seem, is fast closing, if it's still open at all in some places. And Grant, just a word on Taiwan in particular. The Chinese have apparently intervened to prevent the Taiwanese from gaining access to some of these vaccines. They've done a pretty remarkable job, the Taiwanese, of managing this CCP virus, as I call it. And yet they do seem at this point to be confronting a bit of a spike. And it's unconscionable, but not altogether surprising that the Chinese would try to prevent the people of Taiwan from being protected against this pandemic that they unleashed on the world. How do you see things in Taiwan at the moment in terms of the willingness to resist what the Chinese pretty clearly have in mind for them, namely forced submission if it isn't rendered voluntarily?
They're still resisting, and there really is just very few people in Taiwan who want anything to do with China, and probably even fewer that want to be run by China. That is just nobody wants that, except for the people who are actually on China's payroll.
So the former Kuomintang team that seemingly was really throwing in with the Chinese have lost such support as they had, would you say?
They've got a lot less. They're still, as I say, Taiwanese Quislings, but even within the KMT, that there's more people that say, you know, we can't play that game with China anymore. But as I said, there still is a fair number of, Quisling is the right word for anybody who would want to submit them and their countrymen to a regime like the Chinese Communists.
Yeah, a term from, of course, World War II, in which I think Norway was being subjected to that kind of behavior.
That's right. I should have said traitors is the better word. But China is Taiwan still is resisting, and you're seeing with the COVID the Chinese virus business that just how ruthless and vindictive and really murderous the Chinese are. You know, and the way that they are treating Taiwan. And there is some talk that these outbreaks are not entirely random, and the Indians are convinced that's not the case. And when you look at Chinese behavior, one has to think that is a reasonable possibility.
Part of their playbook, and I think they have that in mind for us as well, needless to say, for the future, if not already. Grant Newsom, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you for this extraordinary tour de raison. We'll look forward to visiting with you again very soon. In the meantime, keep up the great work you do with our Center for Security Policy and the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies. God bless you, my friend. I'll talk with you soon. Next up, we'll speak with Dr. Richard Fleming, a remarkable medical expert on that COVID virus, what it is, where it came from, and what it might mean for you. This is Frank Gaffney with a word about a truly great American patriot in urgent need. Rich Higgins served in the U.S. Army and as a key civilian Pentagon official and senior strategist on President Trump's National Security Council. After he left the NSC, Rich continued advising Mr. Trump and others about the threats we are facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. He chronicled his experiences over the past 20 years fighting for America First in a terrific memoir entitled The Memo. Now this courageous freedom fighter is gravely ill due to severe complications caused by the Chinese Communist Party virus. He urgently needs help to defray the enormous costs of successive surgeries and a prospective organ transplant. I urge you to join me in contributing to a GoFundMe campaign named Medical Help for Rich Higgins. That's Medical Help for Rich Higgins at GoFundMe.com. God bless you and Rich Higgins.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It is a delight to say, and a real honor, really, to be joined by Dr. Richard Fleming. You may have come across him, perhaps at Steve Bannon's War Room Pandemic, or through his various products, and we're going to be talking about a brand new one. He has them at FlemingMethod.com. He is a medical doctor, a PhD, and an attorney, of all things. A physicist, a nuclear cardiologist, a man, in short, of extraordinary credentials and skills, which, praise the Lord, he is bringing to bear on behalf of our country as it contends with a medical phenomenon that he has described, among other places, in what has been called his masterclass on COVID, which you can find again at FlemingMethod.com, as a man-made disease. I call it the Chinese Communist Party virus. Others have other names for it, COVID-19 and the like. And we're going to spend the next two segments talking with Dr. Richard Fleming about all of this and the truth that his own research and that of others has made available to us, though it is not generally acknowledged, and why that is and what we best be doing about it. Dr. Richard Fleming, it is a delight to have you with us, sir. Thank you so much for joining us here at Secure Freedom Radio.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
I was struck by how, as I say, you characterized this virus. As you know, we've been thrashing around for months about the origins of this disease. You come down quite categorically on the side of those who say it was in fact engineered and by people responsible for biological warfare in communist China. Tell us why you've come to that conclusion, sir.
Well, as a scientist with 53 years of research behind me, my focus in any issue that I address is to look at the facts, to look at the scientific evidence, to follow the paper trail and the money trail and the patent trail, and to see who's connected with whom and put the pieces together. So I come at it very objectively, very scientifically, non-politically, non-emotionally attached. My goal is to find out the truth and to continue to pursue that no matter what the cost is on some occasions. If you look at the record of gain-of-function research, and your viewers may or may not know what that is, so gain-of-function research is where individuals try to make, in this case, a virus more infective than it naturally is and more harmful than it naturally is. And the premise behind that being that if we could just stay one or two steps ahead of what's going on, there would be an advantage to that. But when you look at this particular virus, and the key to it is the spike protein, that protein that attaches to our cells, when you look at that, you discover that this is not something that is just one or two steps ahead of where these viruses were, but perhaps hundreds or even thousands of years because of the insertions that were placed into them. And you can look at a variety of factors. You can look at published papers by Dr. Shizheng Li of the Wuhan Institute of Virology, and you can look at published research by Ralph Barrick from the University of North Carolina, where these two individuals worked very extensively. They're the experts in the field of coronaviruses, and you can find out that they have published papers showing that they intentionally altered the coronavirus spike protein to make it more infectious. Shizheng Li has admitted that she's put HIV glycoprotein 120 inserts into spike proteins to make them more infective. You can look at Barrick's work, where he and Shang Li have published papers showing exactly what these gain-of-function viruses that they made, what they really are. And then you have to ask yourself the question, where did the funding come from for this? And unfortunately, you will find that the vast majority of it came from the United States. It came from the Department of Defense, who not only provided money to Peter Daszak at EcoHealth, which then funneled that off to Barrick and Shizheng Li. Not only did they provide money, they provided advisors. In addition to Health and Human Services, the National Institutes of Health, the National Institutes of Allergies and Infectious Diseases, USAID, Department of Interior, Department of Commerce, all of which paid more than $60 million to Peter Daszak, who then funneled it off to Barrick and Shang Li. And you can't ignore the fact that there's patents that Barrick actually has that NIH gets monies from that are specifically focused on altering the spike protein of coronaviruses. And you track that back and you see that, yeah, which raises the question, when you have someone like Dr. Fauci under oath before Dr. Senator Rand Paul, and Fauci says, we did not fund any gain-of-function research on this virus. You just have to look at that paper and say, I'm sorry, you did. You did.
You did. And the question that occurs, Dr. Fleming, is why? Why were these kinds of research activities, which seem even to a layperson, I think, so perilously fraught, pursued so aggressively and with so much of our funding by, as you suggest, numerous of our agencies in this government, including the Defense Department, for heaven's sakes.
Right. Well, you get to the place where you have to realize that there's some potential benefit, like I said, if they were just trying to stay one or two steps ahead. But when you continually funnel money to people and there's no control, no oversight, no regulation of the people, remember that administrative agencies like NIAID and Health and Human Services and FDA, these aren't elected officials. These are agencies that are put in place by elected officials. And the Constitution requires that our Congress and our executive branch and our legal branch provide oversight, you know, the legal branch mostly being a balance on things, but provide oversight of this. And when they don't provide that oversight and you have people running amok with money that is just almost limitless, if not limitless, to do what they want, you get scenarios where these people will do whatever they want and continue to push it. And as I tell people, DOD doesn't work with the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts. So in the end, what looks to me happened, other than I know where this money came from, I know the people who did it, is that I think the Americans were playing the Chinese and the Chinese were playing the Americans. And who got caught in the crossfire?
We the people. Yeah. Let me ask you about this spike protein, Doctor, because again, as a layman, like I'm sure most of our audience, this is a relatively new term. But describe, if you would, what that means, both in the context of the COVID virus itself and these vaccines and the implication of them for our health, even if we don't get the disease, but we do get the vaccine.
Right. So to begin with, you know, there's nothing wrong with getting a viral infection. All right. I mean, we get tons of viral infections. And the purpose of this bioweapon wasn't to kill people. When people think of weapons, they think of something that kills people. And that's not the most effective way to win a war with a weapon. You don't want to kill people. You want to demoralize and cripple them. And that's how you defeat an enemy. You don't just, you know, kill the enemy. You have to literally defeat and demoralize them. So from that point of view, the spread of a virus that produces a mass pandemic, shut down societies, shut down economies, has exactly the desired effect that you're looking for. But the spike protein is that part that sits out there on the outer part of the virus that allows it to attach to our cells. And coronaviruses are viruses that have all these spike proteins rotating around. So if you slice through them and you look at just a, you know, a 2D image of them, a slice section like a photograph, you'll see what looks like a crown. And that's where they get to the term coronavirus. And there are seven of these that we know of that actually infect people. There's more of them, but seven that we know infect people, but nothing that it infects like this. In fact, what we know is there's major inserts, more than 1,770 what's called nucleotide bases, which you divide that by 3 and you get the number of amino acids that are glycoprotein 120 or HIV components that Luc Montagnier, the discoverer of HIV who got the Nobel Prize for it, has shown, and specifically a PRRA insert, which every one of those letters stands for an amino acid. And that PRRA insert is referred to as a furin, F-U-R-I-N, cleavage site, which makes this virus extremely infective. So the problem with that is that it increases the ability to infect people. It increases the ability to transmit the virus. The reason why people die, however, is because in people that already have diseases where there's a lot of inflammation and a lot of blood clotting, they have more inflammation and more blood clotting. And if that's not treated, then they die. And one of the problems here is that the federal government interfered with physicians practicing medicine to go out there and begin treating it, and actually, you know, said, look, if you do treatments that we don't like, we'll come after you legally, we'll go after your medical license, we'll do everything in our power to destroy you. So we have a scenario where the federal government has interfered with physicians practicing medicine and telling doctors they can't treat, and there are no treatments, which is what they need to control. And that allowed them.
But as I understand it, excuse me for interrupting, we have to take a quick break here, Dr. Fleming, from one of your counterparts, Dr. Michael Yeadon, is that they needed to snuff all of these other treatments in order to be able to say there's a basis for an emergency use approval for these vaccines. When we come back, I want to talk with you about the vaccines and how the spike protein features in them and what the implications of that are for our public health and safety. We'll be right back with much more with this remarkable, highly accomplished medical doctor, PhD, and attorney, Richard Fleming, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Congressman Eric Swalwell of California is back in the news. It appears this inveterate practitioner of Saul Alinsky's brand of radical leftist political warfare is complicit in an actually illegal act against Representative Mo Brooks, a Republican colleague now running for an Alabama Senate seat. Of course, Swalwell's latest misconduct involving the use of a process server who unlawfully entered Mr. Brooks's home as part of a frivolous lawsuit pales by comparison to the significance of his previous episode involving the serial betrayal of his country to our enemies. Specifically, this member of the House Intelligence Committee accepted sexual favors and campaign contributions from a Chinese communist spy nicknamed Fang Fang. It's no longer possible to ignore the dangers associated with Swalwell's continued access to any classified information, let alone virtually all of our nation's secrets. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi must end that vulnerability now. This is Frank Gaffney. We're back. We are visiting with Dr. Richard Fleming. He has been giving us some powerful insights into the, well, I call it COVID-19, also known as Chinese Communist Party virus. And Dr. Fleming, you were talking about this spike protein business and how it enables this disease to attach itself to our cells. What does the fact that the spike protein is in these so-called vaccines, at least the mRNA vaccines, what does that mean for the health of the patient, among other things?
Well, I think, you know, that's a critical question to be asking people, because once you recognize that the spike protein is a bioweapon, that it's a man-made bioweapon to increase the infectivity and harm of this virus, then you have to ask yourself a different question about this drug vaccine series that are coming out, which is if, in fact, it is exactly the genetic code of this spike protein, and the spike protein is man-made and it's a bioweapon, then the vaccines themselves are the injection of a man-made bioweapon, which raises many more concerns than we've ever had about drug vaccines in the past. And there's a lot of interest right now from people in what's called shedding, the tendency for people that have not been vaccinated to come down with symptoms as if they had been vaccinated. And there's several different vaccine trials that have been looked at, transmissible vaccines and self-amplifying mRNA vaccines that increase the potential for spread from person to person. But the bottom question that everybody should ask is shedding a real phenomenon? And I think to that, we only have to look at the FDA and Health and Human Services documents that they published for guidance to the industry in August of 2015, where they, or 2017, I'd have to look at the document again, one of those 2 years, but 2015, I think, is when it was. And they call these vaccines gene therapy. And they caution the industry on dealing with shedding. So you only have to look at FDA and Health and Human Services to realize that they knew shedding was a real phenomenon, and they put out guidance to the industry.
So just to make sure I'm clear about this, when you say shedding, you're talking about somebody who has been vaccinated with, among other things, this spike protein, being able to transmit it to people who have not been vaccinated and thereby essentially contaminate them and create, presumably, the virus incubating in their system. Is that right?
Yeah, at least the spike protein or whatever's actually included in the biological drug vaccines. Yeah, absolutely. And so when everybody says that shedding doesn't occur or these people are nuts or it's conspiracy, you need look no further than the FDA and Health and Human Services.
Right, their own reports. Yeah. Let me move along because we've got so much more that I want to cover with you, at least quickly. I hope we'll be able to get you back for a longer visit soon, Dr. Fleming, if you would. But the issue of to what end has all of this been unleashed upon us is something I'm fascinated about. You have, I understand, now got at FlemingMethod.com something you call Event 2021, which I understand is not unrelated to an event known as Event 201. Talk us through Event 201 and what you're doing with Event 2021 and why it matters to our understanding of this whole enterprise.
All right. Well, it's important to realize that, you know, folks like me, when we were recruited way back in the 60s, for these doctoral training programs, one of the requirements, one of the things that we had to fulfill to get into it and to keep in it, was to run scenarios constantly of these are the people you have, these are your supplies you need to get from point A to point B, who lives and who dies. And that was a very common strategy that we also had to engage in. Event 201 was very much the same thing. This is what you're going to do to the planet. Who's going to survive? Who's going to die? Why?
Okay, but introduce the dramatis personae of this Event 201. This took place, I understand, in October of 2019. Who brought it about? What was it?
Government agencies, there were several government agencies, my understanding, the goal to see what would happen should a pandemic occur on planet Earth and what the fallout would be and how you deal with that and how you cover it and how you layer it out to the media so that people don't become any wiser and how you deal with the fallout of the consequences.
Two critical additions to that, sir. One is, as I understand it, it was brought about also by several important foundations, including the Rockefeller Foundation, the Gates Foundation, the World Economic Forum at Davos, as you mentioned, several government agencies, including obviously the Centers for Disease Control and CIA, actually. And interestingly enough, the Chinese Centers for Disease Control were involved. And this was a tabletop exercise to explore the implications and impact, particularly on world governance, I think it's fair to say, of something that was actually a coronavirus pandemic. It wasn't just any other.
Right. And so I apologize because to me, this all runs in my mind consistently because when you look at the papers that were published and the funding and the patents, the people that you mentioned, these agencies, they were all the ones that helped fund all this research. So for me, sorry, I apologize. In my mind, they all merge together. They're not separate. I guess they are probably for a lot of people. So thank you for bringing those back.
Well, just for the point of saying, these are people who were actively gaming how something very like what has happened would benefit their cause. And that's the reason I emphasize it. So carry on. Tell us about Event 2021 and what you have done to sort of address all of this afresh.
Right. So what we also learned from all those training exercises was that the only way that you could break something like that from being successful is if you disseminated the truth to people, even if it was challenging for the people to know about. So Event 2021 was a 4.5-hour presentation by myself walking the general public through from beginning to end the monies and time and effort spent into building the spike protein to make this SARS-CoV-2, an explanation of why people then become ill with the disease COVID-19, an explanation of the research that we've published showing that you can treat COVID-19. In fact, I have an outline already showing that the massive cost that it would take for the most effective treatment in the United States to treat a patient infected with the virus to deal with this is $75. And the least expensive one was down to $20. It only worked 72% of the time, but the $75 one worked 100% of the time. Probably somebody would break through.
So tell us a little bit about that, if you would, sir, because that obviously gets people's attention. What sorts of therapies are you talking about for that?
Right. So the outpatient treatment that we saw that was 100% effective was a combination of hydroxychloroquine, primaquine, and clindamycin. And those weren't chosen by chance. Those were the result of many months of research on my part to develop the study looking at how viruses attach. And that worked 100% of the time. And as I tell people, if you get enough people, somebody's going to break through. The next most common effective was hydroxychloroquine and clindamycin. Then the third most effective that worked 3/4 of the time was hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin, and finally hydroxychloroquine and doxycycline. These are all dirt cheap drugs, but exactly like you mentioned earlier, if you have treatments, then there's no emergency use authorization documents. And the incorrect use of PCR, which is how it was used, a very good test, but it's supposed to stop at 20 cycles, according to Mullis, who actually patented the test, the last person to take on Fauci, who ended up dying mysteriously from a pneumonia in 2019. And you no longer have the incorrect use of PCR testing. You no longer have experimental drug vaccines being pushed on people that have no documentation that they actually produce an immune response. But more importantly, if you go into the emergency use authorization documents like we did in this presentation, and you take the data out of it and look at the hard data, you will discover that there's no statistically significant difference between people who got vaccinated and people who did not get vaccinated. It didn't statistically lower the incidence of COVID or death, but it did increase risk. It did increase the ability to inject this bioweapon into people, and there is data that shows that this spike protein can reverse transcribe itself, or in other words, get into the nucleus of our cells where our genetic codes are, and it looks like it combines with that genetic
code. Dr. Fleming, there's just too much to take aboard, let alone to fully comprehend in this brief visit. I commend you for what you're doing to try to educate the rest of us, and especially I want to get you back after I've had a chance to take 4.5 hours to visit with you in Event 2021. Thank you for your time today, sir, and for the extraordinary expertise you're bringing to bear on all of these issues, and for your willingness to share that expertise with us here at Secure Freedom Radio. We look forward to doing so with you again. We look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.